I'd like to speak to you this morning about something that you will soon discover is a passion of some importance in my life. And it has to do with the professional practice of education. I know that that sounds a little strange, but I hope in the next 45 minutes or so it will become increasingly familiar turn of phrase to you. And really, the text for my remarks is the problem that I perceive to be central to our work as educators in the current political, social, economic environment. I think possibly that most educators and most people who educate people in schools and school systems perceive themselves to be professionals in some way. I do not think that that perception is shared by the public at large. I know that it is not shared by people in positions of political leadership. And that's the problem I would like to put to you. I'd also like to assert, although I'd be happy to discuss the evidence upon which this assertion is based, that professions are social organizations that have a practice or have practices. And that it is the absence of a practice which is most problematical to education at the moment. Now, this grows out of the work I'm currently doing with the Connecticut Superintendents Network, which is a group of first 12 superintendents that's been working together for going on 6 years now. And then last year we started a second cohort of 12, so there are now 24. And the central problem of that work has been to develop a model of professional practice for the superintendency, which is centered on the improvement of instructional practice and student performance. The idea that the practice of senior administrators at school systems should be anchored in the core technology of the organization, should be focused primarily, not incidentally, on the improvement of instructional practice, and that in the current culture, the way we construct administration, this is in some ways an heroically countercultural activity. Beginning last fall, I decided to try to take the work to the principalship. And so we started a leadership network in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which consists of the principals of the 12 K-8 schools, the leadership team from the high school, three or four senior leaderships, the leaders from the district level, and the president of the teachers union. And we have been working similarly to establish a practice of leadership that is focused on instructional improvement. Concurrently with this, growing partly out of my interest in accountability and professional accountability and ways in which professions organize and govern themselves, I've been engaged in a kind of parallel set of observations of medical practice, both as a patient and as a scholar, as a researcher. The model we have developed in these two networks is based quite explicitly on the medical rounds model. It is a highly structured model in which we do rotations through classrooms Superintendents spend one full day a month in a school, in classrooms, and then a full day off-site in an analysis and debriefing session. The observations we do in schools are based on something called a problem of practice. The problem of practice is defined primarily in terms of something you can see in the classroom that results in a larger systemic or school-wide strategic problem. That is to say, something the system is not doing well for students. The idea is to develop the competence of practitioners in understanding and studying their own practice in relation to the core concerns of the organization, and by learning a practice, working with each other to develop the people with whom they work. That is, to learn the practice of developing the practice of the people with whom they work. So those are the core ideas. Now, where did the motivation for this come from? Some of you know that I spent about 3 years in Community District 2 in New York City, which at that point in time was, and I think still is, although the district itself has largely disappeared through two generations of reorganization, a beacon in the practice of instructional improvement. That is, it was in some sense the first, although some would argue with it, the first real example we had of breaking through the traditional problem of scale in high-level instruction for children of color and poor kids. That is to say, at the peak of its work, you could step into any classroom at random in District 2 and see the imprint of a very specific point of view about how children learn and about how classrooms should be structured and about how schools should be structured. This result was the consequence of a very intentional kind of professional practice. And with Lauren Resnick and her group at the University of Pittsburgh, we set about trying to study sort of how it happened. I was fascinated by the reaction of educators to the District 2 experience. These are people who read the research. These are people who actually visited the district. Researchers who came in and looked at it. Practitioners who tried to figure out what was going on there. And profoundly depressed by the response. Educators have a way of trivializing the most powerful things in the world of practice. The primary explanation that most educators reached for in trying to explain the successes of District 2 were the personalities of the people who put the strategy together, which of course immediately meant that none of the work that was going on in District 2 could be used anywhere else because there were only so many Tony Alvarados and Elaine Finks in the world. And as we subsequently discovered in San Diego, school boards have a very limited taste for this kind of work. So that knocked me back on my heels. I thought, if we can't show people the evidence and have them be stimulated and provoked to pursue the practice, what is wrong with the field? Subsequently, something happened which happens routinely in education reform, which is education reformers, educators in general, are really practiced at eating their young. P- people turned on District 2, finding many reasons to discount the value of the experiment. I have come to understand that one article of faith in the education community is that no good deed goes unpunished. Now, this, as I say, had a kind of transformational experience effect on me. Because what I saw in District 2 was the practice, not the personalities. What I saw was a very large, I mean, it's a tiny little school system, but a very large number of adults working hard every day, developing their understanding of how to organize for, promote, support high-level practice in the classroom. What I saw was a system, a strategy, a set of ideas that were translated into organization, resource allocation, a set of incentives and accountability system that actually gave people in the classroom a sense of attachment to a larger mission and a sense of exactly what their value added was, for better or for worse, to that strategy. What I saw was a set of practices that were, in fact, countercultural to most of what I had seen going on in schools up to that point. That's not what most of my colleagues in the field saw. Full stop, new paragraph. No Child Left Behind. I'm writing a book now about accountability, and there's a chapter in it about the politics of accountability, and I'm a recovering political scientist. So I've looked very carefully at the political science literature on agenda formation, on the influence that various interests have on education policy. And some of my students have gone quite deeply into this. I hope everyone in this room will have read Liz DeBray's first book on No Child Left Behind, and will read, as soon as possible, her second book, because it delivers a very sobering message. And the message is, educators are people to whom things happen. We do not control the terms and conditions of our own practice. We don't even control the margins of the terms and conditions of our own practice. The terms and conditions of our practice are controlled by people who have no specialized knowledge in the field, who have no understanding of the empirical realities of practice in schools and classrooms, and for whom the main interest is in creating electoral credit, not in producing outcomes in schooling. Because under the current political environment, elected officials in Washington, D.C., including what is now the majority leadership of the Senate and the House, get rewards no matter whether schools succeed or fail. If schools succeed under the terms and conditions of No Child Left Behind, elected officials will take credit for it. If schools fail under the terms and conditions of No Child Left Behind, policymakers get to blame the institutions and the practitioners in them, which produces at least as much and probably more political credit than success. How did we get ourselves into this situation? We got ourselves into this situation because our knowledge has no social and political authority. Take something as mundane and straightforward as pollution control standards. How do we set pollution control standards? We choose a number. That number is based on a lot of data and a lot of research on the operating characteristics of the internal combustion engine. Somebody offers a standard which represents a number. That's the first round of a long debate among people who have political interests and expert knowledge. The people who are affected by that standard mobilize their own knowledge, and the people who are responsible for standard setting set their own knowledge. Fast forward to annual yearly progress. We are now operating all but a handful of schools in this country under a regulatory standard for which there is no empirical basis. None. Zero. There is no evidence to support the existing standard of performance. Period. How does this happen? It happens because the practice that produces the performance has no social or political authority. So the people who use the practice, who produce the work, who make schools run, have no standing in the process. And if you read accounts of the authorization of No Child Left Behind, and if you read how the system of consultation and political alignment has changed in Washington in the last 10 or 12 years, beginning incidentally in the Clinton administration, you'll see that there has been a pretty steady exclusion of any kind of professional knowledge or consultation from policymaking. These things don't happen to professionals. Okay, how am I using the term profession? I'm using the term profession in a very formal sociological sense. Professions are social organizations that control entry through the use of knowledge and the implementation of practice. Professions are people who are organizations that exclude people from practice based on knowledge and competence. Professions are social organizations that are empowered by virtue of their social and political authority to say what practice is. Okay. So, you'll see that my daily work, I'm now spending 3 or 4 full days a week doing rounds in classrooms, has a purpose. The purpose is to introduce the idea that administrators, and teachers for that matter, can in fact develop a deliberate way of organizing, understanding, perpetuating, and using their practice in powerful and productive ways. Now, that notorious footnote that Stephanie referred to is, I'm not sure all of my colleagues who are engaged in this enterprise with me share this passion quite as much as I do. I think they think of it in a little more mundane terms than I do. So I don't want to identify them with this particular mission, although I'm happy to provide whatever cover is necessary for that. Okay, now I'd like to talk to you just a little bit about the challenge that we're facing in the field of professional education. I'll be straight with you. I can talk, you know, elliptically about this. I tried to find as inaccessible a sociological term as I could possibly come up with to put a label on this. In the event that anyone who's in this room wants to declare that they weren't here. I would say that I'm on record as saying that the existing institutional structure by which we train, educate administrators is bankrupt, that the existing regulatory and certification structure is a cartel, that it produces what cartels produce, which is self-serving and self-interested behavior. In this sense, I share Arthur Levine's pretty straightforward and I think pretty irrefutable conclusion, not particularly original, incidentally, that the incentive structure by which we educate and train and certify practitioners in this field is built on a set of incentives, revenue maximization for the institutions involved, that are at odds with professionalism and are at odds with the production of high quality practitioners. Everyone in this room, I'm sure, is exempt from this criticism. So you're all safe. But what I want to talk to you about is a special manifestation of this this problem, which I call isomorphism. And what I want to tell you is that, in my view, and I think that there's a nice empirical paper to be written about this, which I hope to write soon, the central pathologies of the institutions by which we prepare and train educators are an exact reflection of the central pathologies of the institutions by which we deliver education. And that it is this isomorphism which is the culture that makes it impossible to develop a professional identity. And I'll just give you a few examples. On my list, there are 10 or 12 examples of isomorphism, but I don't want to bore you with the entire list. Separation of teaching from administration, structurally. Now, we've all read the history. We know how this came about. Teaching as low-skill work, teaching as women's work, administration as men's work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That legacy is still instantiated in the structure by which we run schools of education, and it's deeply instantiated in the way we organize schools and school systems. You know, there's a lot of talk about what a profound effect No Child Left Behind has had on the way institutions work in education, like schools and school systems work. Now, I happen to have the privilege of working with a lot of school systems that are on this task of instructional improvement in a pretty big way. But once I get out of that orbit and walk into a room of non-select superintendents and principals from just random districts who walk in the door, I have to say that two-thirds of those people are completely clueless about the work of instructional improvement. They have absolutely no idea where to start. They don't know how to turn the page. Now, this is in a system of just draconian and patently arbitrary regulatory policy. This is in a system where people are supposed to be getting flogged and put out of business for not performing. And yet, a very substantial proportion of schools and districts out there have no idea what they're doing around these issues. So here we got it, you know. We got the people who are responsible for running the system out of touch with the people who actually produce what the system is supposed to produce. We've got it in schools of education, and we've got it in the institutional structure. Even in the presence of an accountability environment in which we're supposed to be just banging people's heads together. Now that, my friends, is a definition of a very resilient culture, right? This is like we're driving the car off the cliff, right? The separation of research from practice. One of the things that you understand when you watch physicians work is that there's a lot of understanding and reflection on what constitutes knowledge. And especially in the medical rounds model, and I'm now talking not about grand rounds, which is much about sort of a big event in which there's a big research question, and the senior physician sort of presents the problem. I'm talking about what are called attending rounds, which are the daily work of physicians as they migrate through hospitals and groups. One of the things that you discover by watching these people is that the boundary between pretty sophisticated research and craft knowledge is very permeable and continuous. That is, you're really accountable for whether you know what the current state of medical practice is in a given area. And much of the discourse is organized around whether you know that. But there's also quite a lot of knowledge that has to do with the practice of diagnosis. A lot of protocol, a lot of norms, a lot of structure, a lot of social indoctrination occurs in these settings. So that there is, as a result, what I think a lot of educators would regard as a kind of seamlessness to the discourse between very particular, very specific problems of practice on the one hand, and whatever the governing theories are of the etiology of disease that shape current medical practice and the procedures that are designed to make people better. The analogy I like to use with my students is my colleague Catherine Snow at the Graduate School of Education, who's an expert in literacy, chaired a National Research Council committee on reading, and the report they published was Preventing Reading Difficulties. I won't ask for a show of hands for how many people have read it. The report essentially says, for all but a trivial proportion of kids in the general population, there's no reason why every child shouldn't be reading fluently by grade 3. Here's the research, here's the practice that goes with the research, and here's what it looks like when it's operating in a real setting. Now, what's interesting about that is that that report and its results has had only very, very selective effects. It's largely unread by practitioners and largely unassimilated into practice. A report of similar import, a report that did a similar review of the literature in a field of specialized medical practice would produce the following effect. If within a year you weren't practicing consistently with the results of the report, you would be called an ex-practitioner. Right? That's the definition of a weak connection. I see it in ed schools. I see it in the world of practice. And it's almost perfectly symmetrical. Finally, I just want to give you one example, and then I'll move on. There's a big disjoint, which I think we all struggle with, between how we teach in practitioner programs, on the one hand, and what we teach about. That is, I think the current, here's where I disagree with Rick Hess. I actually think that there's a lot of very enlightened content, at least in some parts of edited-in programs, and relatively enlightened notions of leadership. But for the most part, and that leadership, and that that teaching about leadership is focused on, sincerely, on trying to prepare people for the world of practice. I think that's, so it's not a problem that people in the field are not aware that they're training practitioners, and that the practitioners have to do real things. The problem is that we don't have the social organization embedded in the institution and the ways we teach so that people who are studying the content are also doing the practice under the supervision of people who are experienced practitioners and who have assimilated a body of knowledge. And we've done that because that's the way universities work in this area. We've done that because that's the way school systems work in this area. We have these elaborately contrived rituals for internships and a lot of other things. But in fact, I think most of the people in this room would say that the kind of supervision that occurs in internships is, on a good day with the wind behind you, about C minus. Right. One of the things you discover from watching medical rounds is really tight supervision. Physicians talk to each other in ways that educators wouldn't dream of talking to each other. Let me just say, this is not the land of nice. And it has a huge socializing effect. And in fact, if I could parachute you into the debriefing sessions with our superintendents and principals, you would hear a kind of discourse among them that you do not hear commonly in schools. Tough, blunt, specific, causal talk. That happens not by mistake. That happens by planning. So what I'm saying here is that we've got ourselves into a situation here where the institutions by which we're trying to do this work are not built to do the work we're asking them to do. And for this reason, it's not particularly surprising to me that the work is migrating offshore. Boston now trains 100 teachers a year in the Boston Teacher Residency Program. And probably over the next decade or so, we'll be training basically all the new incoming teachers in Boston, if they can get control and build scale. Now, is it a great teacher certification program? I think one of the things they've discovered is that they can make all the same mistakes everybody else makes. That's not the point. The point is they've moved the business out of the institutions that originally had it. And I had the privilege of sitting in a meeting with all the ed school deans in one room when they announced that they were going to do it. And you have never seen such wing flapping, such protestation. Boston now has a principal certification program, and within, I would say, 2 or 3 years, they will have a sufficient backlog of certified principals so that they will either be not dependent at all on the institutions they've traditionally gotten their principals, their new leaders from, or they'll be in some sort of a preferred provider arrangement where you're actually going to have to get certified by the system for quality control and content before they'll even consider applications. Chicago, New York, my guess is that just about all the big systems will, within 4 or 5 years, be in this model. The educational service districts, which serve smaller districts, professional development, let me just say, have their eyes on creating their own training and certification programs for smaller districts. So this is going to migrate out of the districts which are large and have the economies of scale and the ability to do this into social organizations which are going to serve other districts. The business is going away. It's going away for a reason. It's going away because the school systems perceive that there's something profoundly wrong with this cartel, with this relationship. Now, what I want to do is I want to dissociate myself from evaluations of this. I just want to say it exists. I think that one of the interesting things about the professional networks that I work in is that they have very non-traditional. I was afraid this was going to happen. My computer is misbehaving. So you're going to see this PowerPoint slide for a very long time. Yeah, actually what you have to do is shut it down and start it up again. And so now you can just pay attention to me and ignore what's up on the screen. What's interesting about the professional networks that I'm involved in is their agnostic relationship to institutions. In effect, what's happening is a lot of experimentation with alternate ways to think about the institutional support for propagation of ways for professionals to get together around the work. And I don't think that the people who are organizing these professional networks have a point of view or a model in mind about where they want to end up eventually. I think they're driven by a need to get the work done and get it done as quickly as possible, and to get people into situations where they can have a powerful professional development experience and develop a strong professional identity, and they're agnostic about the institutional arrangements necessary to do that. Most of the superintendents I work with, the foundation people who fund our work, the donors who fund our project with the Harvard Business School, are agnostic. All they want to do is to see, they want to see results. They want to actually see practitioners working in settings with a strong theory of action and the capacity to produce demonstrable results. I think this is actually an opportunity. It's an opportunity for the institutional structure to sort of rethink itself. But I want to tell you, this culture has survived more ingenuity and more firepower and more intellectual dedication than all the people in this room. It's bigger than all of us. It's incredibly resilient, and it's incredibly pathological. All right. The next thing I want to talk to you about is the power of protocol. One of the first things you notice when you observe professionals work, and here I'm talking about people who work in social organizations that meet the kind of formal sociological definition of professions, is that their practice is not identified with who they are as a person. The people are separate from the practice. And the instantiation of this in the work is the use of protocol. So you're on final approach to O'Hare. The weather's a little gnarly out there. And the pilot comes on the intercom and says, you may notice something a little different about this landing. I've always wanted to try this without the flaps. You go in for your pre-surgical conference for cardiovascular surgery, and your surgeon says, you know, I was driving in this morning, I had this flashback, this epiphany. And I think I'm going to do this one the way we did it in 1973. You know, now we have all this fancy technology where you make a little cut here, and then you go in with all this really fancy fiber optic stuff. No, I want to just crack you open, bust you up. It's been a long time since I've been able to do that. Right? You're in final negotiations with your architect for the planning on the new high school, and the architect says to you, I found a way to get that extra 3,500 square feet. All we need to do is to relax the load restrictions on the roof, and these things only collapse about every 10 years. Now, what's interesting about each of those cases is if you do any one of those things, you are called an ex-practitioner, right? Now, I think there's a at least I think at the classroom level, I'm not so sure at other levels of the system, but at least at the classroom level, there's a profound misconception in the culture of education about the meaning of professionalism. Professionalism in education equals autonomy. So that anything that compromises the individual's judgment in their practice is considered to be anti-professional or non-professional. What I'd like to submit to you is that that is a profoundly anti-professional point of view. Professionals are not people who exercise autonomy in their practice. Professionals are people who subscribe to a body of knowledge. They use that body of knowledge to control entry to the work. They deliberately get rid of people who have not mastered the body of knowledge. And insofar as autonomy of judgment gets exercised, it gets exercised within pretty well-established protocols, and it gets exercised on the margins of existing knowledge. That is to say, every profession has people who are pushing the boundaries of the knowledge out. That requires high levels of judgment. We're paying a very high price for this definition of professionalism. It means essentially that educators are what I would call, in terms of the identity literature, they're primordialists, which they believe that the practice is inextricably connected with the identity of the person. That is, we are what we do. Let me just say, if we had that point of view in the practice of medicine, we'd be still sawing people's legs off without anesthesia, right? Because the mark of a profession is that people can dissociate themselves from their current practice, examine it, analyze it, get rid of it when it doesn't work, and still not have their identities as individuals and people and powerful people in the world deeply challenged. So primordialism is alive and well. It's alive and well in the way we teach leadership. We use a lot of attribute theories. We teach that successful leaders have personal characteristics, right? Rather than practices. We associate effective teaching with the personal characteristics of the teacher rather than the practices of the teacher. What this means is that in order to change the practice, we have to get rid of the people. And you can't do this in a mass profession. So we're stuck, I think, in a box. What protocols do is they help people distance themselves from their practice. Protocols help to structure discussions around the action, the behavior, the cause and effect relationships between what you do and what you hope to produce by what you do. They provide an armature where people can structure discussions about their practice and maintain strong personal relationships with each other in the face of very challenging talk about the effectiveness of what they're doing. And they provide an occasion for bringing knowledge into the discussion without threatening the identity of individual players. So in the Superintendent's Network, we have protocols for observation, we have protocols for analysis, we have protocols and norms for how we conduct discussions. We do verbatim records of our discussions. We code them for content analysis. We pull pages out of the transcript of these discussions, and we present them to people, people read them, and we evaluate our own work as practitioners. Speaking personally, this has been a fairly traumatic experience. This has been a tough row to hoe. But what has happened, I think, which is topic of the next thing I have to say, is that people have learned to be much more explicit about their theory of action, which is we actually ask people to write it down. That is, if you're a superintendent or if you're a principal, how do you get from what you do every day to some improvement of classroom practice, to some change in student learning? How's that represented in the way you spend your time? How's that represented in the kind of knowledge that you consider to be relevant for your work? How does that represented in who you seek out as professional colleagues? How is that represented in the ways in which you structure consultation inside your organization? Now, when people initially try to do this, it's pretty awful. It reads sort of like the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. But we put people in groups of two or three, and we stay with it over time, and they critique each other's theories. And by a year or so into the work, we get the grain size down to a point where people can actually assign cause and effect relationships to what they do on Wednesday morning and what they expect to have happen in the fourth grade in literacy. It's sometimes painful, but I think most of the people who've been through the process think that it's fairly productive. Just three quick lessons from what I think we've learned in these professional networks, and then I'll stop and you can interrogate me. Point number one, the resilience of the default culture of American instruction. If you've read any of the international studies of student performance and teaching practice in the US, you see that there are certain robust patterns of instructional practice that are unique to the US, that are highly destructive to higher level student learning, and that are deeply, deeply, deeply rooted in the structure of the institutions and in people's beliefs about the nature of teaching. Just a couple examples. When you code classroom practice for level of cognitive demand, that is, what are the nature of the questions, what are the tasks that students are being asked to do, do students understand the tasks they're being asked to do, and if you did the task, what would you know how to do? You get a number in our networks that looks pretty much like what the data say in the aggregate about the US, which is 80% of the work is at the factual and procedural level. And students have no idea what it means. Not a clue. Not a clue. And the really depressing thing is they're not even procedurally fluent, right? We have kids who are in state-of-the-art literacy instruction now, cohorts of kids who've been through the entire elementary grades receiving very high-level literacy instruction, where the classroom culture is completely different from the default culture. We have longitudinal data that says that these kids cannot do things in the eighth grade that we knew they could do in the fifth grade, right? That is, we have the student ID number, we have the task, we have the level of performance on the task. We follow the student to the eighth grade, the student can't do the work. That's called the subtractive value of schooling, right? Those institutions are sucking knowledge out of kids at a phenomenal rate. Just literally by main force, just like a vacuum cleaner, just sucking it right out. So if you let up any second, just for one moment in the grade structure, particularly in the middle grades, it's all out the window. It's like kids were never introduced to it. You have to reteach it all over again. This was pretty shocking. Point number two, if I were to show you the transcripts of descriptions of instructional practice in nominally high-performing schools and nominally low-performing schools, you would not know the difference. That is, the patterns of practice in nominally high-performing schools look pretty much like the patterns of practice in nominally low-performing schools, which suggests to the degree that anything different is happening in nominally high-performing schools, it's not a consequence of instruction, it's a consequence of social capital. Big surprise, right? Shocking, revealing. A middle grades principal in a brand name Connecticut school district, close enough to New York to be a bedroom suburb, which shall go unnamed, asked teachers in the seventh grade to take everything they asked a student to do over the course of a week and just put a copy of it in a Xerox box underneath their desk. At the end of the week, she got all the teachers in the gymnasium, put out a big continuous table, and just put Bloom's taxonomy on the table. Said, take the stuff out of the box, put it on the descriptor that most characterizes what you think the task is about. Guess what? 80% of the work, 85% of the work was procedural and factual recall. So the way I say this to my students in my instructional improvement class is, you don't change a culture like this. This culture has been defeating people who try to change it for decades. You don't change a culture like this. You replace it. Right? You take it out and you put something else in its place. And the way you do that in the initial stages is not pretty. It involves requiring people to do things that they think are impossible to do. That's not the end state. The end state is you build up the capacity and culture to the point where those people are the ones who are making the decisions about what's the next level of work is. But if you ask people to do high-level work in classrooms in the current culture, they will do low-level work and call it high-level work. The predominant pattern of our observation is teachers teaching high-level content with low-level pedagogy, right? Right. So this is a pretty daunting problem we're involved here. So I think that's the reason why we have started to focus our work now on vertical as well as horizontal networks. I've always had a bias toward vertical networks, that is, networks that go from the central office through the school down to the classroom. We run most of our professional development institutes in the summer at Harvard on the vertical team model. People ask me why if I feel so strongly about that, why do I run professional networks for superintendents and principals? And I tell them it's the Willie Sutton model, which is, that's where the money is. You've got to do it somewhere in order to get an existence proof. But increasingly, I think you don't change a culture like this unless you get strong vertical alignment. And that involves, I'm increasingly convinced, lots and lots of work across boundaries. And I know the medical analogy is getting tiresome, but I just want to conclude with one last observation. I was in Ohio. We're doing, between the Public Education Leadership Project, which is the project we have going with the business school for big urban districts, and the Wallace Foundation project, which is now in two states, Kentucky and Ohio, we're in, I don't know, something like 15 good-sized districts. I got a question just the day before yesterday from a very knowledgeable person in the audience who said, you know, the analogy to medical practice isn't very good because hospital administrators don't have to know anything about medical practice. And I think that's a recurring theme in the discussion of our work, right? And my response to that is the hospital administrator isn't the right analogy. The right analogy is the chief of medical practice, the chief of surgery, the chief of endocrinology, the chief of orthopedic surgery, because that's the professional, that's the vertical alignment that you want in professional organizations. That is to say, you want a social structure which selects for high levels of organizational, professional, and substantive expertise, and you want a social structure that forces practitioners every day to be in the work, right? So if you're a superintendent, you shouldn't be able to choose which days you're in classrooms and which days you're not. You should have the same round schedule that everybody else has. If you're a principal, you shouldn't be able to choose which days, on which rotations you're in classrooms or not. That's part of your job. Nor should you have a schedule in which the administrators are doing all the observing and the teachers are doing all the teaching, right? One of the things we teach people to do is how to create schedules so that teachers are available to be in each other's classrooms, sometimes in the presence of administrators and sometimes not. So that you can see that there's an intersection here between high levels of organizational and managerial expertise about how to design organizations, how to put people in connection with each other, and how to make the work flow across the organization. That's our comparative advantage, right? And there's a role for deep understanding of what good and powerful classroom instructional practice looks like. And I think it's our challenge to try to figure out how to do that. Either within the existing cartel or outside the cartel, we're going to have to do it. Thank you very much. Questions, comments? Yeah. Yeah, it's a great question, and I think it's the thing that I didn't mention that is a natural offshoot of this analogy making, and that's what it is. Medical rounds is a kind of metaphor for what we're doing. The chief distinction is that education is a public profession, and in medical practice, because of the status differentials and because of the kind of immediacy and urgency of the work, it's not hard for physicians to construct a lot of distance between social distance between themselves and the people they are serving. Hippocratic oath to the contrary notwithstanding. That won't work for us. That is to say, parents and children have to be part of the conversation. Teachers have to be part of the conversation. That's why I think the quicker we move from where we are right now, which is I'm doing these basically role-alike professional networks with administrators, to some more integrated vertical model, the better off we're going to be. And in fact, the principals and the superintendents have already folded that into their practice. So what they're doing as a consequence of participation in the network is a lot of vertical work. The problem is that the model that we're working from doesn't do that. And you can see us drifting in the direction that you describe, which is treating classroom practice as a kind of clinical project, right? About which we know a great deal and teachers don't know much, right? And treating them, as you were describing patients being treated, or treating students that way. One of the things that happens when you turn a bunch of educators loose in a classroom and you give them a protocol, an observation protocol, is that they very quickly start identifying with students. One of the first things you see is how little connection there is between what teachers are trying to do in classrooms and what's actually represented in the work of students. So it's not terribly destructive the way it's currently constructed, but it's not a model I want to pursue into the indefinite future, and it's not a model around which I think we should exclusively develop our professional practice.
We publish it.
Okay. Thank you. I think I've just gotten the hook here.
Sorry.
Yeah.